Blood on the River by Alyssa Carbon. Chapter 11, page 81. Hereupon the president was contented the fort should be palisade, the ordnance mounted, his men armed and exercised. William Simmons, editor, The Proceedings. Reverend Hunt kneels with me in the dirt in front of the altar. He puts words to the prayers I cannot speak. Please take James' soul into heaven with you, because he was just an innocent child. Then he lays a hand on my shoulder. Samuel, he says, you've been here a long time. Have you finished your prayers yet? I shake my head. How can I finish praying for forgiveness? It was my fault, I say. My throat feels dry as sand. I should have explained to him the danger of running to the ships. I should have been kinder to him so he would trust me. I should have been able to grab him and pull him back into, page 82, the tent. I should not have let him go when he hit me, bit me. I had so many chances to keep James safe, and I failed at all of them. Reverend Hunt stands and reaches down a hand to pull me up. I take his hand reluctantly and rise. He looks into my eyes. When our Lord spoke of forgiveness, he did not only mean forgiving others. Sometimes we have to forgive ourselves. I swallow past a lump in my throat. Now, go wash your face and see if there's any breakfast left. You won't be able to work if you don't eat. Reverend Hunt gives me a little push, and I leave the chapel. I trudge through the work of the day, sewing up holes in tents and mattresses, bringing water and food to our makeshift hospital, where Dr. Wooten tends to the wounded men, dumping more water on our wilting plants. Richard's eyes are red and swollen. I don't know what to say to him to make it any better. I don't think he wants to hear from me anyway. I wonder if Richard will ever forgive me for my meanness to James while he was alive and my failure to save him. That afternoon, Captain Smith, Captain Newport, and their party return. They say their Indian guide had acted strangely. He left them suddenly, with no explanation. This made them suspicious that a raid was being planned, so they sailed back to us as quickly as they could. They are dismayed to find that they were right. Page 83. In the evening, the council calls a meeting to discuss our situation. I creep near the cabin where the council members are talking so that I can eavesdrop. These are not just disorganized people living in towns here and there, says Captain Newport. They are tribes within an empire. Their emperor is called the Powhatan. The people are the Powhatans, and the river we named the James River, they already call the Powhatan River. They are a kingdom of warriors. The boys are taught to use bow and arrow when they are 6 years old. Their mothers don't even give them breakfast until they have shot their targets in the morning. When the great chief Powhatan wants to conquer a new tribe, the warriors get their job done very quickly. There's a prophecy they told us about, says Master Percy. The bay we first entered on our way here, they called the Chesapeake Bay. There used to be a tribe, the Chesapeakes, living on its shores. The prophecy says that a threat to the chief Powhatan's empire will come from the Chesapeake Bay. When he heard this, he sent his warriors, and in one day they wiped out the Chesapeake's tribe. There must have been 400 of them last night, said Captain Gosnold. If it had not been for the cannon scaring them off, they would have easily killed us all. There is silence, then. No one wants to tell President Wingfield that he was wrong and Captain Smith was right, page 84, about building a palisade, I think. President Wingfield, to his credit, had been at the forefront of the battle. Those who saw him said that he fired his musket, even as an arrow went right through his beard. I hold my breath. Please, someone tell him we need to build a strong fort. All right, President Wingfield's voice breaks the silence. There will be watches, armed men at every corner and shifts throughout the day and night, and... He hesitates a moment. Tomorrow we will begin the construction of a tall palisade with not so much as a crack between the posts. I let out my breath and creep away before anyone catches me listening. Fear makes us work fast. We fell trees and make them into palisade posts with wickedly sharp tips. We dig a trench and a large triangle around our tents and plant our posts so close together an arrow cannot get through. Each corner of the triangle is rounded like a half moon, with a platform inside. We bring cannons from the ships and mount them on the platforms. We are making a fort, like soldiers in a war. Thank goodness the sailors are still with us. They, along with our laborers, soldiers, and other working men, are the ones with the strength and speed to get the job done. If we had to depend on the gentlemen, many of whom still don't want to dirty their velvet, we would be at the mercy of the Indians for many more weeks. As it is, the natives mount small attacks every other day on any man or creature who strays too far from our guarded, half-built fort. They shoot Master Clovel while he is out hunting. He comes running back to the fort with arrows sticking out of him and dies soon after. They shoot and kill another man in the woods when he drops his slops to relieve himself. They even shot one of Captain Newport's dogs while she is sniffing after a rabbit. Captain Smith finds me using a hatchet to sharpen palisade post tips. He is holding a belt, sheath, sword, and armor. I recognize the sword. It has a C molded into the handle. It belonged to Master Clovel, whose grave I just helped to dig. Samuel, do you think you can put some of that energy from your fist bites into learning to use a sword? Captain Smith asks. My hatchet stops in midair. Yes, sir, I say. I try not to sound too eager. You are, after all, apprentice to an officer, he says. It is time to begin your training. I lay my tools on the ground and wipe my hands on my slops. You're lucky, Captain Smith says. Master Clovel was a slight man. His belt and armor will fit you well. And they won't fit Henry or Abram or any of the other, page 86, unarmed men who want them, I think, with arrows flying every day, weapons and armor more coveted than gold. Captain, you're not taking my worker, are you? John Layden asks. He is the carpenter overseeing the building of the palisades. I'd better take him now and teach him a thing or two so he'll live to work another day, Captain Smith says. John Layden nods, and I've got permission to leave. Master Clovel's armor is a little bit big, but it fits well enough. I will grow into it. The breastplate makes me feel like I have a large chest. I wrap my knuckles on it and admire the clang. No arrow can pierce this metal. The helmet is heavy. I feel like a soldier already. Well, I have a musket, too, I ask. First you will learn to use a sword, Captain Smith says. I fasten the belt around my waist and pull the sword out of its sheath. The handle is smooth and cold, and the sword is heavy. It glints in the sun. I take it in both hands and whip it through the air. It makes a sharp whoosh. Captain Smith begins my instruction. I want to think about the sword, but he tells me I must think about my feet. I watch his feet as well. It is like dancing, he says, but I have never learned to dance, and so it is all new. It is a dance of death with your opponent, he says. You mirror his steps until you see a weak spot, and then you lunge. He suddenly steps forward, knee bent, and I am stuck in the chest with his blade. I gasp, but look down. Captain Smith laughs at my terrified expression. Did you forget you were wearing armor? I let my breath out in a rush. No, I lie. You must block me. You don't let me enter your circle. Slowly he goes again for a lunge. I think fast, swat his slade with my blade, knock his off of its course toward my chest. Very good, he shouts. We pattern our steps as in a slow dance, him giving me time to balance his movements with my own. He raises his eyebrows when he's about to strike, his signal to me to protect myself. I hear the satisfying clang as my sword knocks his away. We speed up, our feet moving more and more quickly. No time for thought now, only reaction. I am out of breath, sweating, our swords clanging, ringing out. He's always one step of me, always quicker. I am tiring. Then I see a gap, my chance to enter his circle. I step forward. Lunge. Suddenly there is a scraping, a pain in my hand, and my sword is wrenched from my hands. It lands on the ground behind me, and I stand there, unarmed, with Captain Smith's sword hovering just in front of my throat. I am defeated. But Captain Smith laughs. It takes a long time to learn to use a sword properly, Samuel. Go pick it up. Page 88. I rub my sore fingers and move them until they feel better. Then I grasp the sword again, narrow my eyes, and concentrate. I will try again. Captain Smith moves slowly at first, giving me a chance to find my rhythm. Then he speeds up as before, and I follow. I put my mind aside and feel only my body stepping, moving. The dance of death sweeps us into its circle. Our swords clash and clang. My breath comes in short gasps. I see the opening. I lunge. My blade finds its mark. The tip presses into Captain Smith's armor just above his heart. He holds up his hand, drops his sword. He speaks slowly. The student, he says gravely, has impaled the teacher. I begin to shake my head. I did not mean to anger him. Then he breaks into a broad smile. I wipe beads of sweat from my face. My hand is shaking. We will train every day, he tells me. Wear your armor whenever you leave the fort. The sword will be no match for flying arrows, but tomorrow I will begin to teach you to use another weapon, one that is much more powerful than this sword. I nod calmly, but inside I am excited. Tomorrow I will learn to use a musket.